Welcome to the ninth luncheon meeting in this season. We have two more left after this, and so we'll have 11 speakers this year, and so far it's been outstanding. I want to welcome you again, and take a moment to, if you would, those of you that have cell phones, make sure they're off. We don't want to disturb our cell phones. I also want to remind you that our next speaker is on April 18th, and it's Robert Diamond, who's president of Barclays Bank. He's been in the banking situation today. Start with your lunch, and we'll start the program. It's Dwight Keller, who's in charge of our student guest program.
I know you all have begun to eat. The old trick among pastors is when we want to get attention in a room, we say, "Let us pray." So I will say, "Let us pray," and offer a word of thanks on behalf of all of us. Lord, I am praying today to you, our Creator, on behalf of all of us who have so many reasons this morning to be grateful and thankful. We have been blessed. We have been blessed to be in this beautiful place and this beautiful corner of your creation. We have been blessed by all of our families and loved ones, by our homes, our material blessings, and the blessing of being a part of a free land. And Lord, in particular, this day, with the topic before us, I want to offer thanks for the amazing times in which we live, that we can have our lives extended and enriched by so many wonders of modern medicine. We give you thanks for the men and women who serve us in healthcare, in pharmaceuticals, in medical equipment industries, for their dedication and their seeking out new things that can make our lives better. And most of all, Lord, I give you thanks for the wonderful bodies that we have been given. As the Bible says, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And now I offer thanks for this meal and for the time of fellowship we have around these tables and for all that we're going to learn from our speaker. May we, O Lord, through his wisdom, become more informed and intelligent and dedicated citizens who can make a difference in this world. I ask all of this in the name of the God whom I love and serve. Amen.
Amen. You know, each one of these months is in honor of high school, and Mike Keller is in charge of our guest program, and I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Malcolm. We're really pleased today to have as our student guest six outstanding students from Seacrest Country Day School. And students, would you please join me? We've got a couple of them here at this table, and then we've got them scattered around with special hosts. So students, if you would please join me. And every time I remember it, I always thank the sponsor of the students. The sponsor pays the cost of having the students and the faculty member here. And our sponsor today is Richard and Linda Smodge. Richard is the owner of Advisors Trust, which provides specialized solutions and opportunities for high-net-worth individuals, executives, and Fortune 1000 companies. Richard and Linda, would you please stand and let us thank you for your sponsorship. There they are. And now I told the students that they will have 1 minute each to speak to us and tell us about their past accomplishments and their goals for the future. Let's start with Marcel Koff. Marcel.
My name is Marcel Koff, and I'm a junior at Seacrest Country Day School. I was born and raised in Germany, and actually just moved to the United States 3 months ago. I spent my last semester in New Zealand and attended a high school there, so I'm international, I'd say, and I'm very interested in languages. I love languages and also history and politics. So I'm kind of looking at a career in that area. I'm very happy to be here. I like the United States. I'm very glad. And I think Seacrest is a great school. It's a very small school, so the teacher can focus on each individual, and I enjoy that a lot. And I'm very glad to be here. I haven't decided yet where to go to college, whether in Germany or in the United States. But I'm glad, I'm happy, and yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, please welcome Von Roth. Von.
Hello, my name is Von Roth. I am a sophomore at Seacrest Country Day School. I don't have a story like Marcel. I wasn't born in Germany. I was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I have been in Naples for the last 11 years. My interests are basketball. The Seacrest Country Day School basketball team, we got second round, the semifinals, and then we lost. But I made it to the regional finals for the 3-point shootout, so that was fun as a sophomore. My interest for college, the area, I would like to go somewhere on the East Coast. I've always been a Duke fan, so maybe someday I'd like to go to Duke to study. My interests are in business, business management. That's actually all. Thank you.
Next is Chelsea DeRose. Chelsea.
Hi, I'm Chelsea DeRose. I'm a sophomore at Seacrest, and I don't have any story to tell. I've basically been up here my entire life. And basically for college, I'd like to get away from Florida a little bit. But I would still like to be next to the water, because I think that's very important to me. I tend to want to help people who are less fortunate, and I would love to pursue something like that in college. And whatever school can give me that opportunity, I would love to attend.
Next is Alex Beckett. Alex.
Hi, my name is Alex Beckett. I have attended Seacrest my entire life, and I'm now a sophomore. I'd say I've loved the experience, even though I haven't really been anywhere else. And the thing I love most is the rewarding relationship you get with your teachers and the close contact and all the extra stuff you can get through that relationship. And I hope one day I can pursue something in medicine and psychiatry, and I'm pretty sure I have my heart set on Williams from Massachusetts. And that's pretty much it.
Jeffrey Rochers. Jeffrey.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jeffrey Rochers. Once again, I would like to thank everyone for having me today. I was born in Columbus, Ohio, and have been in second grade. I'm now currently a senior. Pretty lucky to have the opportunity since we will be the first graduating class out of Seacrest. There, me and 24 other students will have that honor, so we've had the opportunity to set traditions and set the bar high for the next senior class. I will be attending SMU in the fall in Dallas, Texas, and I plan on studying political science or international affairs. And thank you very much once again.
And then finally, Alexis Messmer. Alexis.
Hello, I'm Alexis, and I'm a sophomore from Seacrest Country Day School. I've been there since sixth grade, so it's been a great experience. The teachers are great. Like everyone else said, they do have a one-on-one relationship with you, and you can learn a lot more that way, so it's really nice. I run track and field and cross country, so my passion is running, and long distance, so it's really nice. In terms of opportunities and where I want to go, I'm thinking Agnes Scott because it's an all-girls college and my mom went there and I want to keep the tradition going, so I'm thinking of pursuing law, and I'm pretty sure that's really what I want to do because I love debating and working in business, so I think that's my calling. So thank you for having me.
Students and Malcolm.
Okay, thank you, Wade. Continuing your lunch, we'll start the program in about 30 minutes. I'd like now to introduce Rob Larson, who's on our board and has been a long time member of the Forum Club, responsible for bringing our speaker here today. Rob?
Bill Weldon for you, and the thing that I enjoy most of all is that Bill Weldon succeeded me at Johnson & Johnson almost 6 years ago now. I'm down here enjoying Naples, and he's up working very, very hard. So I love that. And we were just commiserating and telling some old war stories. And back in 1998, 89. Get my dates mixed up. Anyway, so when I assumed chairmanship, Johnson & Johnson had sales of $950. And people said to me, how in the world are you going to keep it going? So then 6 years ago, Bill took over, and when I left, sales, I think, were about $18 billion. They're now $60 billion. And the question for him is, how are you going to keep it going? And last year, they made $11 or $12 billion, $15 billion in cash, free cash flow, 250 operating companies. So it is a huge company, and Bill Weldon runs it. Bill started with Johnson & Johnson back in the 70s. He was one of the first really true internationalists. Was head of Janssen in Korea, then moved to the UK, ran a development center in Southeast Asia. Then we got back to the United States where he ran our pharmaceutical business and has done all kinds of wonderful things for Johnson & Johnson. He's also on the board of J.P. Morgan, serves on the board of Quinnipiac University, his alma mater. And ladies and gentlemen, you have a real treat in listening to Bill Weldon. Bill?
I want to say a couple things. First of all, I'm probably one of the most fortunate people in the world to be in the job I'm in, because of the company I work for, but truly because of having such extraordinary people to follow. And I do want to recognize Ralph, because he and Jim Burke and others who were ahead of me at Johnson & Johnson did just extraordinary things. And my job has been made a lot easier because of Ralph, and he's a special friend. Now, I also have to tell you that we still have this good relationship, because I'm going to read you a letter he wrote me a year ago. I'm going to read you just one paragraph out of it, and it said, "Now, you know that I'd never pressure you to do this, which is to come here and speak, but you must realize," he probably forgot he wrote this, "but you must realize that if you decline, Dorothy and I and all of our descendants will simply have to leave South, have to move from Southwest Florida under the cover of night." So I figured I had to come, and but more importantly, it's a real honor to be here and to spend a little time with you all. I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about Johnson & Johnson and who we are and the way we work, and then a little bit about healthcare today, because I think we do have some real challenges as we go forward in the whole healthcare industry. Ralph alluded to the fact that J&J is the largest healthcare company in the world today. It's about $61 billion in revenue. Market cap's about $200 billion. And the way we work is virtually we work in three different areas. We have a group that runs our pharmaceutical business, which by itself is a little over 40% of J&J's total revenue, and by itself is about the fifth largest pharmaceutical company in the world. If you look inside it, we have a biotech business, which is the second or third largest biotech business in the world. Our medical device business and our pharmaceutical business covers everything from oncology products to immune-mediated diseases to pain and CNS. We had a young man who wanted to be a psychiatrist for one of the largest companies in the whole area of mental health. We have our medical device and diagnostics business, which makes up about 35% of our total revenue. By itself, it's the largest medical device and diagnostics business in the world. But it covers everything from sutures in the operating room through a company called Epicon to a company called The Pew, which we were talking about with some people earlier today. And I'm fortunate enough to have benefited by it. I have a knee root that was replaced a couple of years ago, and it truly has changed my life. And I think the orthopedic industry is making such extraordinary strides in affecting people's lives. And then we go into the cardiovascular business, where our stents are some of the leading stents in the world today. And then we have our consumer business, which makes up about a little less than a quarter of our business, which goes everything from skincare and Neutrogena and Aveeno to Tylenol, to obviously the Johnson baby products. And most of the five companies within Johnson & Johnson do not carry the Johnson & Johnson name, so oftentimes people don't realize the breadth of the organization and the number of companies that comprise Johnson & Johnson. When you look at the way we run our business, we have a model that we use, and we call it a strategic framework. And many of you have heard about the Johnson & Johnson Credo, or our Credo, which was written basically decades ago by Robert Wood Johnson when Johnson & Johnson became a public company. And I think one of the things that allows J&J to be one of the most respected companies in the world is this document, which we have challenged, debated, and looked at for forever, for as long as I've been in J&J, and much longer before that. And it really sets the priorities of the way we run our business. And the first priority really deals with, and each sentence starts out, or each paragraph starts out with we are responsible. And the first one is, we are responsible to the people that use our products. It could be doctors, it could be nurses, it could be mothers, it could be fathers. So we have a responsibility to the people that use our products. And I talked about the quality of the product and the safety of the product and what they do for the people that use them. The second statement or part of our credo says we are responsible to our employees. We have a responsibility to ensure that there is dignity and respect given to every employee. They're given good, safe working conditions. And we have a responsibility to our employees. The third one is we're responsible to the communities in which we live and work. And that's very important because of the philanthropy and some of the programs that we run on a global basis. More importantly, J&J does a lot, but the employees of J&J do extraordinary things individually. And I think it is very special that we feel there's a responsibility to give back. And the third one says we're responsible to our shareholders to make sure they get a fair return. And I can assure you over the years, the J&J shareholders have gotten a fair return. The thing that's wonderful about this document is it causes basic conflict and tension, because there's a trade-off with each one of these paragraphs. But you have to go down the list. And there were extraordinary decisions Ralph made during his time. We all know the Tylenol controversy when there was some Tylenol poisoning. And we were guided by our credo saying our first responsibility is to the people who use our products. The second thing we do in running our business is a document that was written years ago that talks about the strategic principles. We now call them our business models. But they're very simple. They say we're broadly based in human healthcare. We have our three business segments. We debate these all the time. We say, should we go into companion pet care, for example? Should there be another area that we go into? How do we look at this? Should we break the company up into three separate units? There's a debate around that all the time, but we talk about being broadly based in human healthcare. We also talk about managing for the long term. And by that, we don't want to compromise the sustainability of Johnson & Johnson for short-term gains. And if you look at the sustainability, whether you look at revenue growth, sales growth, increased dividend, whatever you look at that in, it's been decades and decades and decades that we've had this type of sustainability, and it's because we will not compromise the investments we make in the future for just a short-term gain. We continue to invest in the future. The third one that is so very important is our decentralized style of management. And it really is, J&J is a kind of a, really the reference for decentralization. Ralph said we have 250-plus companies. It's the men and women who run those companies day in and day out that make the important decisions about how we're going to do our business. You debate that again, you could say we could centralize the organization, take costs out of the structure and have a lower cost structure for the organization. But the reality of it is by allowing people to run the business, who understand the business and are close to the business, we have about 48% of our business outside of the United States today. The people that run those businesses are nationals in those countries, just like we have here, wherever we can do that. They understand the business, they understand the government, they understand the needs of the patients for the people in those countries. And it also allows for development of extraordinary leaders. People gain different experiences in different parts of the world, different types of companies, and small and large. We all make mistakes, and if we're given the opportunity to run a small company and make a a mistake. We learn and we grow from it until we get to a position where we're running larger and larger companies. So I think it's a tremendous, I think it is truly the magic around J&J is decentralization. And then the third thing, which is constant throughout all of our, throughout our credo, throughout our business principles or our strategic principles, the priorities we set is around leadership, development of people, and values. And it's something that runs true throughout J&J. And I think that's kind of a brief synopsis of J&J, who we are, how we work, and the commitment we have to the people that we are privileged enough to work for, who are the patients and the people who use our products, as well as the employees, the communities, and and our shareholders. I want to talk a little bit about healthcare. I want to talk about the opportunities and challenges, because I think when you look at healthcare today, there are extraordinary challenges. We're in a campaign right now, and a lot of political questions and a lot of debate around healthcare. But I think when you look at healthcare today, a couple of the characteristics is that healthcare is really looks at diagnosis and treatment of conditions. And I think over time we're going to have to move that to wellness and prevention. We're going to have to move the way we are today out of just diagnosing and treating conditions. And I'll give you an example that I heard the other day. And if you went back a couple generations ago, the cost of healthcare was 4%. Two generations ago, it was 8%. Today, it's 16% of our GDP. And if you think about our children in the next generation, the cost would be 32%, which means we talk about education, defense, there will be no money for that. And you could arguably say it will be higher than 32% if we don't get things like childhood obesity under control, if we don't get diabetes under control, if we don't get some of these infirmities that are really severe and serious that lead on to other comorbidities. We have to figure out how do we do that, and I think we have to do it through starting to give an emphasis on outcomes and on wellness and prevention. The other thing you look at is payers. Increasingly, the government is becoming the largest payer. If you look at the United States, between Medicaid, Medicare, Department of Defense, the VA, about 50% of health care is paid for by the government. And I think as we move into the election and we move forward, you're going to see a lot of debate around whether the government should be able to negotiate pricing with companies, whether they're drug companies or device companies, whether we should have importation from outside of the United States. I think we're going to see more and more debate around these issues. I think the position, if you think about it, on Medicare is the new Medicare bill that was approved a couple of years ago has been extremely successful. It's allowed people to get their medications and take their medications at a cost that OMB, lower than what OMB had felt it should be. Now, the debate will be, should the government rather than private companies be able to supply the drugs and debate and negotiate pricing? The concern that I have, and I think the industry has, is once the government comes in and starts negotiating, you start to limit access and you limit choice. Your healthcare provider won't be given the choice they have today. They're going to be given basically a situation where they're going to have to use what is on a formulary based on price. I think that's a challenge. I think the debate will continue and we'll have to see where we go. But I think there is a concern that the healthcare provider will not be given the choices to treat patients the way they want to treat them. I think on the area of importation, we've seen what's happened with heparin recently coming out of China. You have Canada.com, which is an Indian company. You have a lot of products that have come in outside of the company that have been imported into the country that created issues and problems. And the FDA has a huge task trying to govern all of this and figure out how do they deal with it. So I think there's going to be a lot of very important decisions that will be debated. And there's pros and cons on both sides, and we'll have to debate them and work within whatever we all determine is the best way to work in those areas. I think the other thing, and I mentioned this before, is that the payment system today is based upon the volumes of procedures that are done. I think we have to start looking more at outcomes. We have to start looking more at prevention. We have to start looking more at wellness. I share a committee or a group that was set up by George and Barbara Bush when he left office. They had a daughter who died of leukemia, and they set up a group called the CEO Roundtable on Cancer. And it's really a group of CEOs and as many as we can get together that are committed to trying to create healthier work environments. The point of this is that one of the groups we work with is the American Cancer Association, and I have to admit, I didn't realize this, but two-thirds of cancer is preventable just through lifestyle. You look at tobacco, you look at hypertension, you look at weight, you look at cholesterol, and it's the same thing that will impact metabolic diseases, cardiovascular diseases. It was staggering to me to find that out. I think the more we can start to focus in these areas, I think the better off we're going to be. I think the other thing that we're going to have to start looking at is, and I mentioned this before, is how do we really create the transparency that allows people to make, whether it's the consumer or the healthcare provider, to make educated choices. We can debate the strength of direct-to-direct consumer advertising and other things, but how do we get good, reliable information out to the consumer and to the healthcare provider? There's a group at the Institute of Medicine right now looking at evidence-based medicine and trying to make sure that we have good evidence to be able to get out to people. Another one is, how do we deal with the uninsured? I think most of us are probably aware there's about 45 to 50 million uninsured in the United States. What a lot don't know is about half of those people make an income of about $75,000 a year they can pay for health insurance. But there's a large need on the other side. How do we ensure access for the patients that need them? How do we ensure that they can get their medications or the products they need? I think this is a challenge for all of us as we go forward. I happen to personally believe, and as Ralph said, I've lived in many parts of the world and worked under different healthcare programs. I do believe we have the best healthcare in the world. You know, you hear about childhood mortality, you hear about infant mortality, you hear about life expectancy, but you have to realize that's just not tied to healthcare. It's tied to automobile accidents, inner city deaths and other issues that have taken place, that all ties into life expectancy. So I do believe we have a wonderful system. I think we have the best system. I think it needs a lot of changes. I think it needs a lot of improvement. I think the intellectual property issue is another one that I think we have a great strength here in the United States, which is not as strong in other parts of the world. I think we have to work hard in those areas. There are really, I think, three critical factors that are going to affect healthcare as we go forward and the cost of healthcare. One is the boomer population. People want to feel better, they want to function better, they want to live longer, they want to look better. And I think all of this is driving towards more and more healthcare. Everybody wants that, everybody wants more healthcare, everybody wants all the benefits of it, and that costs money. And I think that the whole demographics of the aging population is going to add tremendous cost to healthcare. We have to figure out how do we deal with that. I think another one is the increasing wealth around the world. When you look at the emerging middle class, everybody talks about the BRIC countries now, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, but you can throw Turkey in there, you can throw Mexico in there, so many other countries you can throw in there that have emerging middle classes and have this extraordinary need for healthcare. I think the demands are getting greater and greater and greater, and the governments don't have the resources to pay. So there's a push and a pull, and I think everything is a trade-off. But I think the demands on healthcare around the world are becoming greater and greater. And I think the last area that's going to be driving healthcare is going to be technology. And when you start looking at technology, you can look at biomarkers, you can look at personalized medicine, you can look at the mapping of the human genome. We were talking about genetics earlier today with somebody. These are going to bring tremendous changes to the industry. Diagnostics, the ability to diagnose diseases and conditions earlier, is going to create extraordinary needs for increased health care. I think the technology and the technological advances over the last decade have been extraordinary, and if you look to the next decade, they're going to be even greater. So I think that we have some real challenges ahead of ourselves, and I think we have to really look at how do we address those, how do we collectively get together. Personally, I believe it's not an industry issue, it's not a provider issue, it's not a government issue, it's all of our issues. And we all have to work together to try and find ways to deal with the challenges we have, because as I said earlier, we all want to live longer, we want to live better, we want to look better, we want all these things to be able to enable us to have a quality of life a lot longer than we ever have before. I think that's very, very important. So I think it's probably a good place to stop. I think I've probably thrown out some things some of you may agree or disagree with. But I think that healthcare is a challenge for all of us, and we really are trying to do the best we can. As you all are bringing cards up, I guess for Ralph and the tough questions, I told him he gets the easy ones I get. But I do think we, you know, it is a challenge. I don't think there are any right or wrong answers, but I do think it is an ability of everybody collectively to get together, to work together, to try and ensure we have extraordinary regulatory bodies, extraordinary science going into our products, and work real hard to get there. With that, I'd like to say thank you very much. And Ralph's got some questions.
Before we let Ralph get to the best part of the program, by the way, Bill, in preparation for your joining Ralph now, you're ready to retire. There's a wealth of knowledge here, and a couple of books I'd like to know. Thank you. One's on Marco Island.
Thank you very much.
And one's on Naples. I show that to your wife, that she can pick up the spot.
I'll do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is the best part of the program. So,
best part of the program is I get to ask me. We've got a bunch of questions here, so I'm going to. Yeah, can you hear me now? Okay. Let's go through just a few of these. There are more we're going to be able to spend time in, but what management guru or thinker has had the most impact on your leadership style?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, in all honesty, I was probably 10 years ago, I was offered an opportunity to lead J&J for an opportunity that was an extraordinary opportunity with an extraordinary company. And my comment was that I couldn't leave because of the people who work at J&J and the respect I have and what they've done. I've dropped a great example of that. I think it's the people that you work with and you grow up with to set an example and help you learn and motivate you. So there's a lot of good people. We're talking about Bill George, Ralph and I were earlier today, who has written a wonderful book called True North, which talks about, commitment to yourself and your own beliefs as you get through management. There's lots of people. But I have to say it's the management of J&J, of which Ralph was probably the most important.
Do you favor a national healthcare program mandated by Congress? And if so, what is the model somewhere in the world?
I don't, and I'll speak from experience. As I said, I lived in Asia, I lived in Europe. I don't think the healthcare in those countries are as good as the healthcare we have here. I think there is a need for all of us to sit around the table, and I do sit on the Commission for City Medicine that's looking at this, where we have CMS, we have the government, we have Mark McClellan, we have the Danny Cortese from Mayo chairs it, Jack Rowe from Columbia's on it, the patient advocate groups are on it. I don't think that a mandated program will ever give us what we will be happy with. I mean, I look around this room, and if somebody says to you, when I lived in the UK, the UK government basically said, if you're 55 years old, you are not worth us paying for you to go on dialysis. Therefore, you pay for it or you die. Now, they've changed. They now put people on dialysis over 55. I don't think there's anybody in this room that would like that. I had a knee replaced. I can guarantee you, outside of the United States, in many areas, I would have never been able to have this done if I hadn't gone into the private system and paid for it myself. I don't think we will tolerate, nor will we get the best care. I do think we have a commitment to ensure that there is access and affordability for everyone in this country. So we have to make sure that we can take care of it. What many people don't know is whether it's Johnson & Johnson or the pharmaceutical industry or the device industry, we supply hundreds and hundreds of millions and billions of dollars of health care free of charge to indigent patients across this country. I think we will have to continue to do that. I think the government has to get involved. But I think mandating health care for everyone is not the way to go.
This is from one of our students. Bill, what would you say is the most satisfying part of your job, and why?
I think the most satisfying part of my job, and I say this all the time, is the ability to have an impact on people's careers. It's working with people, and it's helping people succeed, and you watch people, and you know they're succeeding because of their abilities, but you know you've had a small impact some way, somehow, on people's lives. I actually had dinner last night with a person that worked at J&J for years, who lives down here and is retired, and the person who's, you know, I think I've had a great impact on his career and on his life. And it's that I afforded him some opportunities and I helped him just as others have helped me. And I think the most rewarding thing you can do is to help others. And I think the true definition of leadership to me is when you realize you're working for someone else. So that the most gratification you get or rewards is seeing other people succeed who, in a small way, you've impacted.
What new product or medicines or life-saving inventions are you most excited about at Johnson & Johnson?
Yeah, there's a few of them. There's and Ralph and I were talking about it earlier. We've worked for literally a decade to get a product that we just launched in Europe. We'll be launching in the United States shortly. Anybody that's had major surgery that has a PCA pump and walks around with a morphine drip where you have to push a button to get morphine in and you're trying to move around carrying the stand with you, it's very awkward. We've created a product called Ionsys, which is about the size of a credit card. It is a patch you put on your arm, it has a battery in it and a narcotic, and you just push the button, push the battery, and it delivers the drug. It's going to have a huge impact on surgical areas. There's another one that's called conscious sedation. And it will. I work at the RAND Group out in California, and their healthcare group thinks this will be one of the most important changes in the area of surgery, and it's the ability to sedate patients and take them down to a level that they can do surgical procedures done on them, or endoscopic or diagnostic procedures done in an outpatient setting, and take patients down through the use of this instrument we've developed, the propofol, which is a drug that will allow them to go down to a level to be maintained, will be able to be done by the surgeon, and will allow access to a lot of procedures and a lot of diagnostics, and I think it will change the face of surgery. We just submitted to the FDA for approval in that area. And then there's probably three other products that I think are amazing. Two of them actually are in the area of the HIV/AIDS area, where we have come up with products that are effective in about 97% of the resistant strains of HIV and are true breakthroughs in that area that are going to have huge impacts. And we have a product for tuberculosis that could be the most profound change in the treatment of tuberculosis. We will probably partner with an outside group, and this will be part of our, as I said, the third part of our credo. It will be something that we will give the product away for development and make available where it's needed around the world and not with the financial gain out of it. But I think those are some really profound, extraordinary opportunities we have going forward.
There are several questions along the following lines. Why do drug companies feel the need to advertise so much?
Well, when I was chairman of Pharma, I actually went on record saying that I think if we're going to make them, they shouldn't be called direct-to-consumer advertising, they should be called direct-to-consumer education. Okay. We have a responsibility to appropriately educate the consumer. Consumerism in healthcare has become very important to me. It's important that there is a dialogue between the patient and the physician or the healthcare provider to really have the opportunity to talk about the treatment, side effects, benefits, what else is available. And we think that education is very important. Whether you're going to get it off the internet through advertisement or whatnot is, it doesn't really matter. I think it's the being responsible in the way we advertise. And I think J&J has really taken a lead on trying to change it from, I said these cartoon characters that you put on TV don't do a lot for me, but we have a physician talking about the problems, the opportunities, and what could be done. I think that's important. Personally, and it's just personal feeling, I don't think there is a need for advertising. I don't think we have to advertise, but I do think we have a responsibility to get information out to the people that will either be have our products used on them or will be using the products on people.
How can we increase the education of more nurses, RNs, and LPNs?
I think that was almost a setup, because when Ralph was at J&J, we started a problem because there was we started a program because there was such a Freudian slip, right? No, we started the program then, which really we recognized was a problem with nurses in the United States, and worked with the nursing associations and did what we would call public service programs. I'm sure you've seen them on TV, that talks about the importance of nurses. We've moved it now, I guess we've done it for a generation now, for 10 years, a decade now. We've moved it now to nursing educators. But what we did is we tried to draw the attention to the importance of nurses in healthcare and the value they bring. And actually, the enrollment in the nursing school, since we've run that program, have far exceeded the ability of the schools to take on nurses where there was a decline. They were shutting down the schools. And we've been recognized time and time again for this. I think nurses are extraordinarily important. And what's happening now is we have to make sure we have enough nursing educators to make sure that the nurses get the training they get. But it's something we've felt strongly about for a long time and have been leaders in trying to drive that forward.
Are all of your drugs made in the United States?
No. We have manufacturing facilities all around the world. We have manufacturing facilities in Ireland. We have a very large company in Belgium called Janssen Pharmaceutica, which is probably the premier company in the world for CNS and major tranquilizers, and drugs like Risperdal and Invega, which we make. And we manufacture drugs in Puerto Rico as well as the United States. We also have a manufacturing facility in Xi'an in China, which we were one of the first pharmaceutical companies to move into China. So we manufacture, we're a global company. As I said earlier, we have 48% of our business outside of the United States. So we do our manufacturing in various parts of the world.
We've got several more here. Any thoughts about the fact that many procedures and medicines and oncology and else and other areas are available in Europe for years before they're approved in the United States?
I'm not really aware of that. Historically, the United States has been the first place where companies have gone to get most of the approvals for drugs. In probably in the last 5 years, the U.S. has become very, very strong on the area of safety. And with the pharmaceutical industry, you have to understand there's a balance. We call it the risk-benefit ratio. And what is the benefit you get versus what is the risk that you have to take? All drugs have side effects, and they have benefits. And what's happened is the U.S. has really been looking closely at the risk-benefit relationship, and drugs have historically been approved quicker in the United States. I think at the FDA now there's been a requirement for more and more work. And then, to bring a drug to market today costs about $1.2 billion for about 10 years of research. Whereas a decade ago, it was about $350 million to bring a drug to market. So I think we're starting to see applications in different parts of the world based upon different needs. As I said, we've launched Ionsys in Europe, which is our patch delivery system. But I don't know of any area where there is, in Europe, where there's an easier route of administrative approval than there is here in the United States. I guess everybody looks at the risk-benefit relationship, all the regulatory bodies.
Is China, as a country, a serious threat in manufacturing some of our medication? Should we have better controls?
I think you're probably talking about the heparin example, and I go back to toys and everything else, and I know the FDA has now pushed people in the major cities in China to investigate and look into the manufacturing. And you have to look upstream. I mean, that's really what happened with heparin. It was way back in the early side of things that actually led to the heparin. But I don't see China as a real challenge. I think we have to make sure that we support the FDA to make sure that we have the people to investigate, just like we do here, the facilities where the products are coming out of. I think the other thing you have to look at is when you look at China and some of the developing parts of the world, the real reason for moving manufacturing offshore is when you have very labor-intensive products. And most of the cost of goods is in the cost of labor. And pharmaceutical products, that's not necessarily the case. So you want to
You want to make sure you're putting it in where you have the best benefit, so it may not be the developing part of the world. But I think we do need to make sure that we have the regulators and we support the FDA in a way that allows them to be able to oversee and monitor these things. It's just like importation. They need to be able to monitor to make sure we're getting the quality of products that, that we want to get.
Bill, this is a bit of a related question to what you just said. Some say the FDA is broken and needs a major overhaul. Do you agree?
You know, we've gone public saying that we think the regulators, the FDA, it really needs to be strengthened. We want strong science. I think strong science is good for everybody that's committed to research and development. That's what we all want. I think that the FDA has challenges just like the government has, like the industry has, like everyone else has. But I think that they need more funding, they need more resources. But I've had conversations, and the reality of it is the FDA wants to make sure that we are getting better health care, better products to patients, and that's what the industry wants. I think there's a way we can work together collaboratively to look at new technology, new advances, to be able to help everybody get products there. Does it need improvement? Sure. Do we need improvement? Absolutely. I think everybody does, but I think we can move forward in a very productive way.
Bill, can you talk about whether tort reform, how it impacts the healthcare industry, and will tort reform reduce healthcare costs?
That's a given. There you go. We got the answer right here. That's a given. I think the medical legal situation in the United States is a difficult one. I we all saw the Supreme Court ruling a month ago or so that said, now, if the products have been approved and everything has been investigated and looked at, where should the liability reside? And I think that, the Supreme Court was basically saying that if everything's been done right, it's been approved, it's been investigated, that we ought to be in pretty good shape, and the whole medical legal issue shouldn't be so tough. I what bothers me, and I said it before, is that drugs and devices have side effects. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, it's y'all drove here or walked here. That wasn't risk-free. But you're going to take a drug or have a device put into your body, and you think that's going to live. There's no risk associated with it. Well, that's wrong. We know that they have good effects. Drugs have good effects and bad effects. The problem is when you have a product that's being used inappropriately, where it shouldn't be used, or that there is something that happens. People have been warned about or whatnot, where does that liability reside? So I think that there's a whole, there's a need for tort reform, and I think it will have an impact, a huge impact on the industry, and I think it will probably, if we had that, we'd probably have more advances in the whole area of health care than we have today.
If Johnson & Johnson moves towards prevention, will that include vaccines? If so, will that include the possibility of a merger?
If we're going to merge with somebody, I couldn't tell you anyway. Vaccines, we discuss vaccines all the time. We're not in the vaccine business, but it's a very important business. We talk about whether we should get in there all the time. I think the area of prevention is the real challenge, is how do you start to look at outcomes, and as I said, reward outcomes rather than treatment of a problem. We are working, and actually we've done this at J&J for decades now. We've actually been tracking through a program we have there that looks at tobacco use, and that's just not smoking, it's chewing tobacco. We're down now to less than 4% of our population here in the United States uses tobacco, whereas 20% of the normal population does. That's because we pay for tobacco prevention, we go for education. We have a healthy lifestyles program where we look at hypertension, body weight, cholesterol, and activity. And we actually have a substantially reduced health care payments because of the program we've been running for a long time. We have transferred this program or are working with the UK government to see if we can put that into effect in the UK where they can actually create a healthier environment. We've shared some of it with Walmart and others. The real question on the prevention side is how do you look at outcomes, how do you look at prevention,
and how do you measure it and reward people for that? It's a real challenge. We've been successful in all areas except exercise. We can't get people, no matter what we do. We put facilities, exercise facilities in all of our major companies. We can't get people to exercise. That's the biggest challenge we have. But I think prevention and health is really looking at these performance areas of nutrition, exercise, recovery, or sleep and rest, and you can call it, it's the whole area of setting priorities and taking stress out of your life and how do you deal with that, and that can have a huge impact on healthcare. So vaccines are one thing, but I think you have to figure out what is the business model that you can use to get into prevention, and we've worked with the government here as well as elsewhere to try and look at that.
This is from one of our students here. Clearly, we have a problem with healthcare as medications become more expensive. What are your thoughts on patients receiving medications from other countries, and what can we do to make medications more affordable?
I think this is one of those really interesting questions, because I think the affordability, there's two aspects of it here. One is, and I'll put it off to the side, is the patient assistance program that this whole industry has. If there are indigent patients, we will supply them their medications free of charge. The industry does that. All they have to do is come to us and let us know that they qualify, and we'll supply their medications. Is one thing. The other thing is, we have to really look at our responsibility. And I talked about our HIV products before. We actually went into the marketplace at lower prices than we had initially anticipated going in, because we wanted to ensure that people could gain access to the medication. We're the only company that was praised actually on Capitol Hill because of what we did with these medications. And when we went into the HIV area, and Ralph was there when we did this, we made a commitment that people would be able to get our medications. And we've now set up a manufacturing and basically licensed area with manufacturers in India to supply sub-Saharan Africa, basically at a cost that is affordable. We make no money on it. We licensed it out to ensure that patients around the world in every place get the medications we need. I think the industry has to step up and take a responsibility. I think there is the need for healthcare to make sure that the uninsured have access to medications. I don't think trying to import drugs from outside of the United States is the answer. I just happen to feel strongly. There was work done a few years ago where the FDA went out and seized, it was like 1,800 packages of products that were coming in. 90% did not have approved products in them. We have a contraceptive patch that there was some product being brought in from outside of the United States that was seized, came in from India, that didn't have any active in it. So women were putting a patch on thinking they were getting contraception and they were getting none. The issue of trying to put your finger in the leak in the dam of importation or bringing products in from elsewhere isn't the answer. We have to answer the questions here at home. We have to deal with them.
Okay, as we draw this session to a close, I have two questions, one statement. Will Big Pharma make more purchases of biotech companies? And if not, why not?
I'll give you an interesting statistic, which I wasn't aware of. I was in California last week, and I met with a fellow who used to be in the government and is now a venture capitalist in the healthcare area. And if you looked over the last decade, the return on an investment in biotechnology of a dollar has returned 92 cents. I mean, most people don't think about that. I wouldn't have thought that. But it's because there's 450 biotech companies out there, and everybody hears about the Genentechs and the Celgenes and the Genzymes. But there's a lot of other ones there that don't return anything. So if you pick the right one, it's a home run. If you don't, you're going to have a challenge out there. Do I think biotech's really important? Yeah, we bought the company called Senecor back in 1999 for $5 billion. And it's now probably generating $5 billion in revenue annually. It's an extraordinary company, and monoclonals that has done extraordinary things. I think you have to be selective. I think biotechnology is very important. I guess we move forward. One of the benefits today that biotech has is the whole area of being able to be very specific
and to work in very specific areas. I think biotech will play an important role and an increasingly important role if you look at the biology. You look at immune-mediated diseases and what some of these products have been able to do for the arthritides. Extraordinary things. But I think that we'll continue to, and everyone else will continue to invest in that area, but I think small molecules will also be very important. But I think biotech will play a very, very important role, but it's not the bullet that's going to give us all the right answers.
And this is the final, this is not a question, this is a statement, Bill, which you'll be pleased with. But congratulations to your Vice President, Chris Poon, being selected one of the most influential women in America today. Her hometown of Wyoming, Ohio, is proud of her. I look forward to meeting her next September when she returns to her alma mater, Wyoming High School, as Teacher of the Year.
Thank you all very much.